I'm glad you mentioned the Paramis, Mary, because I think that they are probably among my favorite of the teachings. I find that the Paramis show up over and over and over again in various ways for me in my life, or maybe it's just what I notice because I love those teachings. And last time when I was here a couple of weeks ago, we were talking about wisdom as of all of the Paramis. The one you can't actually just do. Wisdom grows inside of you. Wisdom shows up and affects all of the other paramis. I think it flavors them in ways. And of course, all of the paramis, generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, truthfulness, patience, determination, loving kindness, energy, equanimity. I probably left one out. But they all are mutually interdependent. Anyway, last time we were talking about wisdom, we spoke about it through the window of the five daily reflections of impermanence, of loss and illness and death, and the truth of interbeing and interconnection. And we had some conversation about that we all experience that differently. And we do. We experience all of these paramis differently through our own lenses, through our own conditioning. And that's the only way we can experience it. And then over time, with our practice, we begin to pull back the layers and maybe have a little wider perspective, a little wider capacity, and see things not only through our own lenses, but to have the broader perspective that we pretty much all want the same thing, and we come to it a little bit differently, and our experiences of impermanence and dukkha are. They're not the same as each other, but they are experiences of dukkha and impermanence. And so we hold that with a quality of empathy for each other and ourselves. The other thing that I was thinking about, Mary, when you were speaking about coming together to talk with each other, is the importance of creating a community of care, which is this is obviously a community of care, and what a delight it is to be part of a sangha that knows each other. And even though we might not know each other, there's a like-mindedness, a like-heartedness that is here, and we can feel each other. And it always amazes me what happens on Zoom, that I don't know if you feel it, I hope you do, but I feel like I'm in the room with you. And it might be because we're really accustomed to it. We've been doing this for a long time now. But I think it's kind of amazing that we actually can attune to each other when we can see body language to some degree. Obviously, we can't see our whole selves. But we create these sanghas that are wherever the sangha is, whatever kind of sangha it is a community of care, in which it's very helpful to have certain kinds of guidelines. And we start with chanting the refuges, which in its own way is a kind of a guideline. They're not the precepts, but the precepts are guidelines. And one of the guidelines that's important to me that I think that we all bring in, especially whenever we're talking with each other, is this invitation to listen generously to each other, to ourselves. One of my teachers says, "Can you listen?" If I see if I can get it right. To listen with the ears of your heart so the other part of yourself can be heard. That's not exact, but how do you listen in so other voices inside of you, parts of yourself that might not be so accessible, actually get a little air hole. Does this make sense to you? I think this is what happens when we quiet in meditation. You know, the wisdom voice arises. I was teaching with Sylvia last year, and somebody asked a question, and she leaned in. I think I may have shared this with you before. She leaned into the screen and she said, "I am listening intently. I am listening intently." It was such a beautiful moment because she was, And the person who was asking the question, which was a very tender question, really felt it through the screen. And we can do that for each other. Which is why I love this poem, How to Listen. This is holiness. Two people seated together on the pew of a park bench, right? At the altar of a kitchen table. It doesn't take much more than that. This is this sacred interaction that we have, this place that is so beautiful that we can listen to one another, listen intently and generously. Thich Nhat Hanh says that mindfulness allows us to look deeply and see what's going on. It means seeing and knowing what's going on. And that's always been very poignant and meaningful to me, because I think that one of the chinks here, one of the pivot points around, we think we know what mindfulness is, but to see and look and know what's going on, how do we do that? That's our practice. It might sound simple on the surface, but I don't think it is. To see and know. So what does it take? It takes an understanding of the Four Noble Truths, of the three poisons of greed and ill will and delusion, of dukkha and impermanence and interconnection, right? The three marks, to really understand how these things work together, and back to what Mary said, why it matters, right? Dharma in daily life. Why does it matter? Because we can all study these teachings and have a concept of it. That's fine. It's conceptual until we actually live it. That question, how is it showing up? What is showing up for you? So I've been lately teaching a series on the paramis and various sanghas, and we bring in these three questions, three compass questions that I find very helpful to guide my own practice, my own experiencing of how this shows up. One is, what makes a meaningful life? For you, what makes a meaningful life? Now, I don't mean what's the best part of your day. I actually mean it a little bit differently. And this comes from Atul Gawande. Anybody read his book, Being Mortal? Jan, you have. Yeah, and Bill, it's a fantastic book. And it's, I don't know, it's 5-8 years old now. I'm not sure when he wrote it. But Atul Gawande is a palliative care physician who studied the advent of nursing homes and what is happening as people age and lose agency and lose capacity and are more and more dependent on others for their care. And so when he begins his work with people, he will ask the question, what's the most meaningful part of your day? As to a way to find out what's important to them. What is it? What are their values? And how can care for them be sure to include what is meaningful? It's a really important question, and it could be a very beautiful reflection question for the Sangha. What makes a meaningful life? What is a meaningful part of your day and why? What happens? What's going on? Another question that I often bring in, and I'm sure that you've heard many times before, is what do you know to be true? That's another way of saying, what have you learned? What are those things that you've learned in your life or in your practice that become ballast, that become very important places where you know you can, it's a refuge, another kind of refuge, which you can trust that, it's a reliable place. And of course, this wonderful question from Suzuki Roshi, well, it wasn't his question, it was a question to him, what is the most important thing in this practice? You know, and his response is famously to find out what is the most important thing. And that is that teaching that I think Bhikkhu Bodhi said, just do two things, begin and keep going. And to begin and keep going and to keep doing that over and over again helps us develop what is meaningful, helps us develop this wisdom that we talked about last time of what we know to be true, that felt knowing of yes, no, or not sure, the capacity to discern, which requires listening, listening in, listening to each other intently and generously, openly. So I want to move into a discussion tonight and next week about renunciation and equanimity and the relationship between the two. Because I think there is. I think there's a very distinct relationship between renunciation and equanimity. So let me, hang one sec. So here's a lovely little piece. If you can sit quietly after difficult news, if in financial downturns you remain perfectly calm, if you can see your neighbors travel to fantastic places without a twinge of jealousy, if you could happily eat whatever is put on your plate, if you can fall asleep after a day of running around without a drink or a pill, if you can always find contentment just where you are, you are probably a dog. Have you heard that before? It's great. I love hearing that over and over again. Because we're not dogs. We don't find contentment everywhere, wherever we are. We can't eat the same thing over and over again. My dog could never eat the same thing over and over again. I mean, whoever thought that dogs could just eat the same crunchy, dry stuff every single meal? Anyway, you get the point, right? It is hard work to stay equanimous. You know, the Buddha famously said something like, happiness is contentment with whatever there is. Do you believe that? Do you experience that? You know, of course not, right, Carolyn? I mean, happiness is contentment with whatever there is. This is our practice of equanimity. You know, to be able to say, right now it's like this. And we have all these Dharma adages that basically say that. So is renunciation an expression of equanimity? Is equanimity an expression of renunciation? This is the ground. So this is where we can begin and come back over and over again. One of the things we can do is have a sense of humor. You know, we really can laugh about some of these teachings that might feel a little head spinny. Like you might think, am I supposed to believe that just because the Buddha said it? You know, it's wonderful to question. It's wonderful to say, well, how does this show up in my life? What does it mean happiness is contentment with whatever there is? I think what he was talking about is a capacity to meet whatever is happening with a quality of willingness, of curiosity, of openness, of responsiveness, as opposed to constriction and reactivity and judgment. So we know the Four Noble Truths. Difficulty happens, we tend to make it worse. We don't have to. Here's how. Beautiful way of describing suffering and the end of suffering and the path leading to the end of suffering. But Ajahn Brahm, who is a British-born Ajahn and has a center in Australia, I think in Perth, he's actually a pretty funny guy. And he has come up with, as opposed to the Four Noble Truths of suffering, the Four Noble Truths of happiness. And I love this because I am a very much a glass half full type person. And so this works for me. So here you go. This is what he teaches about it. As opposed to there is suffering, there is happiness. And as much as we know that dukkha is ubiquitous and we all experience it, he says the same thing about there is happiness. It is our birthright. It is our innate capacity. And as Rick Hansen says, we are wired for happiness. We come in that way, and then we have all the conditioning that kind of gunks it up, and we have to just take it back apart to find out the truth that there is happiness. Thich Nhat Hanh says, happiness is available, please help yourself. And I think what he meant by that is a quality of contentment. We're not talking about Hallmark happiness. We're talking about, like, you can be really, like, it can be a really rough day, but you might find that you're still okay. A quality of resiliency that can be developed. And then Ajahn Brahm says there is a cause of happiness. And I think the cause of happiness for our discussion tonight are the development of the heart practices of generosity, the experience of generosity, whether you are the recipient or the giver, doesn't matter. Morality. We know that when our ethics are in order, there's a lot more happiness, right? Because we're not causing harm. Oftentimes, we're not receiving it either. It is a much more stable place. Renunciation. We'll talk a lot more about that. But simplifying, relinquishing, decomplicating, that's not even a word, but uncomplicating things leads to some contentment, wisdom, energy, patience, for sure, patience. So much easier, right? When we, like we talked about in the book that Mary mentioned, Crossing the Floods, Ajahn Suchito's book on the paramis, the way he defines patience, you might remember this, is to relax the edges of time so something else can arise. That is a cause of happiness. Truthfulness leads to contentment. Determination to keep going, right? Just do two things, begin and keep going. There's a quality of stability and momentum that happens that I think leads to happiness. Certainly metta, and then developing this equanimity. So that's the second noble truth of happiness. There is a cause of happiness. And the third, as opposed to the way he talks about, instead of there is an end of suffering, there is abiding happiness. Isn't that beautiful? There is abiding happiness, that peace is already here. Just like Thich Nhat Hanh said, happiness is available, please help yourself. Peace is already here. This is this Buddha nature. And when I said in the meditation to allow the front of the body to soften, to become receptive, to invite this quality of sati. Sati, as you know, is often translated as to mean mindfulness. Bhikkhu Anālayo says, no, actually, sati is a quality of mind that comes before the mindfulness can arise. It is the soft receptivity of mind that makes space for the mindfulness to arise. And when I heard him say that, it changed me. It changed my practice and my understanding of the components of mindfulness, a quality of mind that we know when, I know, when my mind is constricted, I'm not very curious, not as willing, not as open. You know, these qualities that are required of mindfulness. But when my mind is softer and open, I can see more clearly, right? There's this curiosity. I can say, well, what else is going on here? I'm more likely to be able to be in a conversation with somebody who has a different opinion if my mind is not constricted. And that is the outcome of sati. And we are cultivating this every single time we sit in meditation, breathing in, breathing out, resting, coming back over and over again, steadying the mind towards clarity and balance so the mindfulness can arise. And if we come back to that definition from Thich Nhat Hanh, mindfulness is seeing and knowing what's going on. We can't see and know what's going on with a constricted, closed mind. And this is the work of sati. So there is abiding happiness. This is the sati. It gives us this access to our Buddha nature. When the mind subsides and opens, peace is possible. Peace is here. And the fourth, there is a path leading to abiding happiness. Just like there is a path leading to the end of suffering, is the same pathway. It's the Eightfold Path, the Paramis, the Brahmaviharas, all of these practices. And you know how all of these, not only the Paramis, but we can start anywhere on any of these lists and just pull one thread, and it's going to lead us to all of the other aspects of practice. Everything is connected to everything else. So this practice, this beautiful practice of happiness, contentment, clarity, is a practice that's a dedication to goodness. I think ultimately this is what we're doing. It's a medicine for suffering. It's a medicine for pain. You can think of it as an antidote. But it comes back over and over again, right? We come back and that question, what are the teachings that are supporting you now? And so sometimes what one needs is to really, really dive into the practices of renunciation, of simplification, or really spend a lot of time with metta. Or maybe one's practice is really lagging a bit. You need a little oomph. So a little determination, a little energy. Come back to Sangha where there's energy that's supportive. And we can borrow that from each other. We do give this to each other just in the showing up. So I'm thinking about this a lot, about the relationship between renunciation and equanimity in a very practical daily life way. Later this year, my husband and I are going to be moving to Colorado. I may have mentioned that earlier. And it's a big deal. We've lived in the same community for over 40 years, in the same house for almost 30 years. So, you know, we have to give up a lot. And we're cleaning out and purging a life in this house. And what do we literally let go of? What are we figuratively letting go of? And how do we maintain our equanimity that we've chosen to do this? It's exciting. We get to go live near our kids. It's wonderful. And yet there's loss. There's upset. There's, you know, there's a lot of not equanimity, and or whatever we call not equanimity, agitation. But there's also a lot of it because we know why we're doing what we're doing, and it is really exciting. And so I'm very much experiencing how these things are working together. The choice to let go of so much in the service of this thing just came up on my computer. I got a little distracted. You know, sometimes advertisement comes up in the middle of the thing. Sorry about that. So I'm thinking a lot about this. So I'm going to take a few more minutes and then we're going to talk with each other and we will continue on this next week. Nyanaponikatera, who was a German-born monastic, the way he defines equanimity is a perfect, unshakable balance of mind rooted in insight. Isn't that beautiful? The perfect, unshakable balance of mind rooted in insight. I don't have a perfect, unshakable balance of mind. Sometimes it's very, very steady. And in those moments, it's such a relief. It's so lovely. And then it goes away because it's what happens. But I love that it is rooted in insight because this stresses the importance of our wisdom. What have we learned? What can we let what we've learned really support us to come back to this place of abiding? So a balanced, spacious stillness of mind that easily accommodates everything that happens, the way we can soften our edges so we have space for a wise response instead of a prickly reaction. And I'm not saying anything you don't know, I'm certain. But it's just another time to come back to talking about how does equanimity actually work. This mind heart that can say, all right, this too, this too. With the understanding that impermanence is in here, right? Everything is going to change. Just wait a little bit more. If you don't like how it is, wait. If you like how it is, wait. All of it. Norman Fisher says, can you strengthen your ability to face with love whatever happens next? Can you strengthen your ability to face with love whatever happens next? And this is how we connect the heart practices to the practice of equanimity that says, let's see what happens next. Can we wait? Can we abide here? And I think that, you know, if we were to get down to brass tacks, if you're in this country, things are really hard. And we're in very volatile times that we all know. So this practice is even more important to help support us in globally volatile times in this country, in our communities. The upset of the heart, the fear that could be going on, to strengthen our ability to face with love whatever happens next. This is the importance of these paramis. Our morality, our generosity, our truthfulness, our determination, our knowing why we're doing what we're doing. It's not from an arrogant place like, oh, we're doing something that others aren't. What we're doing is to be a force for good, to not cause harm, to understand a little more deeply how things are, how we can each be in relationship with how things are. So here's a story. An older man, this comes from Ram Dass's book, Polishing the Mirror. Anybody read Polishing the Mirror? It was a pretty sweet book, Vita, yeah. An older man is walking down the street and he hears a voice saying, psst, psst, could you help me? And he looks around and he doesn't see anybody. And again, he hears, psst, can you help me out? And he looks down and there is a big frog. He's embarrassed. I mean, you don't talk to frogs, but he says, did you speak to me? And the frog says, yeah, could you help me out? Well, what's the problem? And the frog says, I'm under a curse. If you pick me up and kiss me, I will turn back into a beautiful maiden and will serve you and cook for you and warm your bed, and I will be everything you ever wanted. And the man stood there for a little while. And then he picked up the frog and he put it in his pocket and he walked on. And after a while, the frog said, hey, you forgot to kiss me. And the man said, you know, at my age, I think it's more interesting to have a talking frog. So here we go, right? Let's keep a wide view. Let's have some perspective here. Stay curious. Avoid impulsivity. You don't have to kiss the frog. And by the way, just from a little bit of maybe a political point, anybody who says, I'm your beautiful maiden, I'll cook for you, I'll warm your bed, run the other way, right? Like, we're not doing that. And when the frog promises you something, maybe you don't believe it, you know, you might not get what the frog promised. Have a little perspective. Trust your wisdom. Trust your wisdom. I have so much more that I want to talk with you about, but I also really want to give space to talk with each other. So I think this is what I'm going to leave you with. I'm going to leave you with what I want to, this next piece that I really want us to talk about, but then we'll open it up. A very beautiful way to start talking about how renunciation and equanimity are in relationship with each other is through the beautiful teachings of what are called the verses of the faith mind from the third Zen ancestor. And here are a few excerpts. And so you might think about this, or you can listen to the recording, because I want to bring this in next week for us to really chew on a bit. It starts this way. The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences. When love and hate are both absent, everything becomes clear and undisguised. Make the smallest distinction, however, and heaven and earth are set infinitely apart. If you wish to see the truth, then hold no opinions for or against anything. To set up what you like against what you dislike is the disease of the mind. When the deep meaning of things is not understood, the mind's essential peace is disturbed to no avail. Stop talking and thinking, and there is nothing you will not be able to know. Do not search for the truth. Only cease to cherish opinions. If you do not discriminate between coarse and fine, you will not be tempted to prejudice an opinion. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. To live in this realization is to be without anxiety about non-perfection. So I want to dive into that next week for sure with everybody, but let's talk with each other now about whatever's on your mind, anything I said. Bring your own wisdom in. Mary, yes, please.
I really like you tying renunciation with equanimity. And what came to mind was, and I'm sure all of us that are familiar with Philip know, his three renunciations. So renouncing the need to be right, renouncing the need to be the star of your show, and renouncing the how you judge how successful you are by getting your needs met.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And I think that for me, those are ones that have really kind of stuck with me. And if you practice those things and don't let them relinquish them, how can you have equanimity?
That's right.
How could you possibly have it? And I think what's really lovely is for me to notice in my life those moments where I am out of my way and I'm not in contention with what the moment is offering.
That is so beautiful.
And the more times I'm able to do that, lovely. And then it's really funny sometimes to find myself when I am in the middle of contention to go,
yeah, and you just say, oh, there it is.
You know, and just like, oh, yeah. So like, yeah, and then it's really funny because a lot of times, well, it is funny, you're not laughing because then you just like let it go. It's like, yeah.
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 I mean, you're human,
yeah,
right? I mean, this is the thing. But to your point about contention, to be without contention, to not be in contention with the conditions of our lives, is so much the meat of the matter here. Because we can have this rub all the time about it's not quite right. I want it like this instead of like that. Yeah.
To really savor them and to notice them, I think, is really important too.
And to notice it. Yeah, thank you. Mary Page.
I've been thinking a lot about equanimity in the last couple of days for some reason. I'm glad you're talking about it tonight. And one of the things I really realize, it's so related to Nibbana or enlightenment. I mean, it seems like, and I was sort of thinking, I think I need brain surgery.
Oh, no. I hope you don't.
Well, I mean, it was like the idea of being able to really, truly be equanimous. It's such a goal. It's such a huge, I mean, it's about the same goal as enlightenment to me, you know, to really, truly be able to be with just what is.
Wow.
It's
a big deal. You know, there's even a line, Mary, in the faith verses about giving up the desire for enlightenment. Let me see if I can find that. Because that one took me aback also. I thought, all right. To live in the great way is neither easy nor difficult, but those with limited views are fearful and irresolute. What a word, irresolute. The faster they hurry, the slower they go, and clinging cannot be limited. Even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray. Isn't that something? It's about the attachment. It's not about that. I think that's so much of what we keep coming back to, is that clinging, that grasping either way, even to the idea of enlightenment. It's hard work. Deborah.
First of all, Colorado is out of the question. Because I can't get there in a few hours.
That's right. You can, well, get on a plane, darling.
And I just want to say, first of all, thank you for you.
You're welcome.
And I love the way you tap into teachings from all, whether it's Tibetan or Zen and Mormon or Theravada, the Ajahn. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And thank you for reminding me of things I used to know or had read or heard before. And yeah, I have had for many years the trouble with this word happiness that you come across a lot in Dharma. And I have felt for myself, contentment is happiness.
It is.
I mean, just not being upset about this or that, or what you just said, wanting it this way or that way, just right here, right now, everything's good. Even if I have a headache, even if my toe hurts, I got the tea, I'm not cold, I'm not hot. Contentment is just such a gift. That's about as enlightened I'm probably going to get in this lifetime anyway.
Well, it's actually very skillful. I mean, what a skill to cultivate, to be able to say, I'm warm enough, I have my tea, and to be okay, right? To be able to say, this is pretty good. This is pretty good.
Well, you know, 30 plus years of illness, I've had to learn to do that, or I'm going to be in a constant state of being happy.
Yep, that's right.
I'm just going to say this with the renunciation part. And this is one of the gifts of getting older. There are others. This is one of the gifts is nothing here is how I want it to be. Nothing in my living space is how I want it to be, including this chair that I'm sitting in. However, I can't let it upset my enjoyment of the moment to moment of my
good job.
My coffee or
that's
my
right.
Beer.
That's right.
And so this letting go, I guess, is how I'm translating renunciation. You know, it's like, I don't want to look at it because it's not this way. But, you know, it's okay. It's been there for 3 years. I'm okay. It can stay there another
good for you. Months. And what a relief. So that is what we're talking about when the mind subsides. That is the end of suffering in that moment. It's okay. We'll talk more about this next week.
I just want to ask you this one question. If it's still niggling at me, there's this little corner that's, I got to get to that. It's really not okay. But it's not predominant anymore. It's like mostly what I just said.
So it's up to you. I would say get to it, see how you feel. Or don't get to it and see how you feel. Thank you, Deborah.
Thank you.
Kylie.
Whoops. Thanks, Heidi. That was just lovely and very resonant, particularly, you know, talking about listening and how our practice of sati, how it shows up and living Dharma.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a terrible week in our home. We have had a sick dog who we had to let go.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Over the weekend. And that dog was a therapy dog for my youngest child, who's now a young man and has grown up with that dog. And my son has anxiety, and that dog has been a wonderful companion. So the process was really shattering and emotionally draining. But my family was able to all come together at the moment of our pet's passing and support each other. And I felt so blessed when my son was crying uncontrollably at the vet.
Mm-hmm.
So blessed to be able to be present with his grief and mm-hmm. not want to turn it off and not want to fix it.
Yeah.
And to be able to hold him and just say to myself, this is grief.
Yeah.
And just be with that.
Yeah.
And help him in that, on that pathway.
Good for you. Oh, yeah. What is your son's name and what was your pet's name?
Oh, my son's name is Jack, and he was a wirehead fox terrier. So I don't know if you all know the cartoon Tintin, but Tintin's dog was called Snowy, and that was a wirehead fox terrier, and he was full of personality, and his name was Ralph.
Ralph. So much meta to Ralph and Jack. It's such a big deal to lose that companion. It is, I know. And for you to be able to say, this is grief and we can hold this, I can hold this. Because grief is love. You know, I'm so glad you shared it with us. Just so much metta to Jack and Ralph and your whole family. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Heidi.
You're
Thank
welcome.
Thank you, Sangha.
Nancy.
Heidi, your talk tonight was so timely for me.
Oh, I'm glad.
About renunciation and equanimity. Like you, I'm in the midst, I've sold my home that I love.
Oh, wow.
And I'm, oh gosh, didn't mean to cry. But I know it's the right decision. And in downsizing, I hope to attain equanimity.
Yeah.
You know, ultimately have the correlation between renunciation.
Yeah.
And equanimity. But right now, I am so sad and stressed. And I just wonder if you have any words of wisdom about how to,
just to first acknowledge that so sad and stressed, I know I'm going to get there. I know that this is going to be part of this. And the so sad and stressed, I think, is also about love. The so sad.
Yeah.
You know, of letting go of something that you've really, really loved, and to let that be okay. You don't need to make the sadness go away. What if the sadness can just accompany you because it's what's true? You know, it is what's true. And it will change.
I'm okay. I'm not sleeping. I'm not sleeping. That's really more what I cry, and I'm okay with that.
Okay, good. I don't know what to tell you about sleeping. I mean, we could talk about sleep hygiene, but it also just to really acknowledge what a big deal this is.
Yeah.
The sleep will come again. You'll probably be tired for a while. And I'm not saying that as a joke. I think that it's just true. That you're going to be tired for a while. And again, this is how it is, the not sleeping. It is stressful. It's by definition stressful. And you can feel it. You know, you can feel it. I don't know that I have any great words of wisdom about this because I'm about to dive into the same thing.
I appreciate what you said. I really
thank you.
Short remark.
Yes, Howard, please.
Good, yes. Two quick things. I've only got 3% left. As what the frog promised,
yeah.
Those are all the things I do for my partner because I address them as the privilege of service, that being there is the best way I can be there for myself. And another thing, part of a poem I wrote was, when dealing with a broken heart. Remember back, my friend, we all got here naked, broken, hungry from the start. The rest is adopted or inflicted, but you can adjust it yourself.
Yeah.
Do.
That's beautiful, Howard. Thank you for sharing that. Thank you for sharing that. Yeah, you know, it's a privilege to love each other, right? I mean, it was a joke in the frog story, and I made a joke about assuming women cook and clean and warm a man's bed. But what we're talking about is how do we care for each other? Coming back full circle to the beginning of a conversation is creating communities of care, relationships of care, listening generously. To listen generously is an act of renunciation. To get out of our own way, to be able to make space, to let go of what Mary said, do I have to be the center of my own show? Or can I get out of the way and make space for somebody else? So we could talk a lot about how generosity and renunciation are also intimately connected. It is 7:31. We have to end. I'm so sorry, Zoe. Is that okay? Can we bring Zoe in? Let's do 1 minute. I don't want to leave you out, Zoe.
I'm sorry. I didn't realize what time it was. I was just going to add to the theme about a major life change when one is moving, whether it's a long distance move or just moving to downsizing or whatever. Having gone through that and having moved from California to the East Coast, that was a life changing move. And I understand the myriad of emotions and the stress and all of it that comes and the loss of what you had and what you cherished. And for me, a lot of that was the Sangha and the community and the just the California kind of culture. And what came to my mind as I was trying to actively listen to everyone is in thinking about that and hearing other people that I know right now going through similar kind of moves is how much courage it takes. And so part of the renunciation, you know, process, which can appear as loss, is also at the same time what shows up, if we allow to see it, is what a courageous thing sometimes is involved in when one is undergoing like a tremendous change. Not that I'm saying that about myself, but I see it in other people, but it does involve sort of a leap of faith and an act of courage as a process in the renunciation of letting go into the unknown. Somehow that seems to, there's an admiration aspect when you see people coming through the other side of it. Cause I've just witnessed someone that I know personally just make a major move of work and moving and life changing. And I would keep thinking to myself how courageous she is because mm-hmm. she's doing it all by herself. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to leave that thought for people because, one needs to validate the positive aspect of what you're undergoing when you're doing it, because all you can feel is the pain and the suffering and the stress, but there's something else that, you know, that you should feel good about, which is how courageous you are.
Thank you, Zoe. That's so beautifully said. And, you know, it did occur to me on this, it is courageous to make a major life change. It is, especially when it's out of choice and not necessarily, well, maybe we could talk a lot about that, but you know how sometimes the Dharma is talked about, one wing is the wing of compassion, the other is the wing of wisdom and connected in the body of courage. So maybe there's another bird that is the wing of renunciation, the wing of equanimity connected in the body of courage. Thank you for bringing that in.